The Paula Gordon Show continues with Dr. Cornel West. We were talking about being an existential Democrat. Well, I don't think most people think about either existential or small-D Democrat, and here you're putting them together. Why did you do that?
Well, I think to understand democracy not simply as a mode of institutional arrangement, but as a way of life and a mode of being in the world. You take a book like Democratic Vistas by the great Walt Whitman, which is his prose, even Leaves of Grass, his poetry. You see existential democracy at work. He is a Democrat who understands that to be is to be self-corrective, self-critical, experimental, improvisational. And democracy is fundamentally about self-criticism, self-correction, self-examination, and allowing for the society to engage in critical, reflective, experimental, improvisational modes of being. So what does that mean? It means that you're against dogma, you're against rigidity, you're against orthodoxy of all forms.
You have just given an eloquent, as usual, definition of jazz.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. That is so true.
This is interesting to me in the myth context. To paraphrase, I think it was Du Bois, what does it feel like to be part of the solution? Because, you know, you started out talking about the blues and about jazz, and it seems that it is dynamic intrinsically because it is not a static state.
Gotcha.
Secondly, it dynamically incorporates contradiction.
Absolutely.
And it would seem to me that if we had to pick a myth, at least, you know, if we were voting today on an option for the 21st century for America, that less the blues than jazz, because it is so rich and varied, and I guess in some ways is much more accessible to everybody than perhaps the blues is. The experience of that, and it is also, it has its optimistic variants and it has its pessimistic variants. It can be played solo. It can be played in small groups. It can be played in large bands. It can be listened to by a broad range of people.
It can be written down or improvised.
And it would seem that would be, you know, if we had to lay out a predicate for, not necessarily that it is, but at least as a starting place, that is the solution.
Well, at least that
a solution
is the best
an approach
way to a solution, but the way is always perennial. But no, I think both of y'all, Sister Paula and Brother Bill, you all are hitting on what sits at the center of my own work. That's why I call myself a jazz man in the world of ideas, because I understand jazz itself as a mode of being, not just a particular kind of music, but a mode of being, and it is a kind of existential, democratic mode of being. That's the connection between Louis Armstrong and a Ralph Emerson, or Whitman and a Coltrane, because it's precisely that. It's dynamic, it's improvisational, it accents the dialectical interplay between spontaneity and discipline, between individuality and community, between unbelievable commitment on the one hand, but also willingness to laugh at some of the products of one's commitment, because whatever you come up with is going to be imperfect, and it's so that there's links between self and society here. You can talk about democratic societies that are self-critical, fluid, keeping track of all voices, especially the most vulnerable, given the history of the world, where elites dominate. But there's also the existential, what I was calling also the Socratic, which is a self-examination. That's not reducible to the social. I mean, the issues of death and disease and disappointment are not reducible to issues of social justice and egalitarian distribution of resources. All are important, but they overlap, but they're not in any way identical, you see. And so I think you've hit on something very real here. I think jazz is a better metaphor than blues. It's just that, you know, there's no jazz without blues. What jazz did was accent the variety of different possibilities that the blues provided.
I hear enormous energy in what you're saying. It's real easy to do hand-wringing into the 21st century, but what you're saying is all possibility.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you can't be a jazz man in the world of, not, in the world of the mind, in a life of ideas, without trying to swing. Swing like Duke, but also swing like Muhammad Ali, which is to say you're fighting with a smile on your face.
And you know you're the butterfly.
And you know you're stinging, and you know you're pulling back, and you're also doing it with style, like Duke and Count and so forth. So there's a double entendre with the sense of what it means to really swing, which is in the end what it means to really love and live and struggle and die.
It also, going back to the characterization of all Americans as black, it is, I think, acknowledged that jazz is the unique American art form. It is a synthesis of, it's the first substantive artistic creation, I think most people would agree, that has come out of this culture 400 years later. And again, that would seem to make it at least a candidate, if not the myth, at least part of the language of the myth.
No, I think that's very true. I think if we were to go back and look at what does the New World in the United States, we don't want to confuse the United States with the New World, you've got Latin American, Central American, Caribbean, but if we focus solely on the United States, the first indigenous art of the United States was the spirituals. And Twain and others knew this. Melville understood this, and they were themselves in search of something distinctive. Emerson raising the question, calling for the Cultural Declaration of Independence, an American scholar, in his famous address across the street from Harvard, there, the old church. He's looking for something distinctive. Well, he doesn't see it's in the spirituals, but it is. But the spirituals then become the pillar for blues. And jazz comes out of that tradition. And jazz is the most sophisticated form of this indigenous art.
And then rock and roll comes out of that. And then hip-hop comes out of that.
Absolutely.
And so all of this continues
into... You got the working class Italian brother named Frank Sinatra, who's in love with the voice of Billie Holiday. You got Bing Crosby from Spokane, Washington, who's in love with the music of Louis Armstrong. It's so intertwined, and this is back to Ralph Ellison's point, you see, that those who are honest say, my God, you know, this is me.
That's tough in a culture that still fundamentally has an awful lot of white supremacy in it.
Oh, no, it's true. It's true. But, of course, the first national pastime in America was minstrels, white brothers and sisters putting on blackface, which meant already they were preoccupied with the ambiguous status of black folk vis-a-vis their humanity, and it freed them up, and there was some actually highly talented minstrels, and Eddie Kander's not the only one. Mm-hmm. and of course the first talkie in America was Jasmine. Mm-hmm. So that the white supremacy exists institutionally alongside the wrestling with this question of what it means to be human. And we've been able to push back some of the white supremacy, but we've got a long way to go. But at this deeper level, what it means to be human, it goes all the way back.
You don't talk much in words that are familiar to me in your writings, at least I don't recall it, about intentionality. And it would seem that in this context is absolutely central. Because for a long time, this country was intentionally racist. Mm-hmm. And intentionally white supremacist. Mm-hmm. With all of the institutions intentionally supporting that perspective. And in this African American century, a substantial part of that intentionality, I think, went away. Mm-hmm. The fact did not go away.
That's right.
But it would seem that alone is a major shift, and in some ways provides the basis for optimism. That once we've gotten rid of the intentionality, so that this is not a willed act, then we can address the stupid things that we do, the old habits of vision, and begin to make really substantive change.
Mm-hmm. Well, it cuts so many different ways, though, because on the one hand, if you figure that you've been able to push back the intentionality, then for so many white fellow citizens, that just solves the problem. Okay, we've done enough. Thank God. That was hard enough. It's over.
We're finished.
I quit.
Exactly. Whereas, as you
it's
know,
a teleological condition. We're talking dirty again.
So then you said, but no, we still got fat. I mean, it's like breaking the back of Jim Crow Senior and end up with Jim Crow Junior. Right? You get legal apartheid. Okay, we broke the back of that. Thank God, courageous citizens of all colors, but disproportionately black in leadership. Actually, disproportionately Jewish in composition and support as well, you see. But then you get de facto segregation. Still get balkanized society, neighborhood, still de facto segregated. If we can't deal with that fact, then we end up deceiving ourselves again. and therefore it becomes difficult to convince folk that there's still a problem here.
This would seem to go to the fundamental challenge of being a public intellectual, because I think most people would argue that an intellectual intrinsically is a non-active condition, that you talk about things but you don't do anything.
Which is exactly where I want to be when we come back, Mr. Russell. Dr. West, we'll all return.
Anything else I can do, just let me know.
Please stay with us. We'll return shortly.